This is Matthew Tombers, and this is WGXC Acra. And I am here today with Tad Mann, who is an astrologer, whom I know through several routes, actually. One from the fact that he is around Hudson, and also I know him because we have a mutual friend in New Delhi, of all places.
Yes, we do.
Yes, we do. And I have visited a year ago or so. I was in Delhi. Spent some time with our mutual friend Raja, and we're here to talk every month, I think it is. I get a newsletter that I've signed up for, and you can sign up for it too, and we'll tell you how during this hour, that talks about current events against the astrological landscape. And perhaps we can open there. What does your letter, because I haven't read your letter last, because it came in last night and I was doing other things, including downloading songs for today's show. So anyway.
Yes, well, I do a newsletter that actually comes out twice every month before the new moon and the full moon. And there is a new moon tomorrow in the sign Gemini. And I do a newsletter that's about 1,000 words or so. It's about 2 or 3 pages. And for those who want to listen to it, there's actually a recording as well. And I have quite a good sized mailing list. But the whole idea of it is to really just see what the astrological climate is in any given moment. And what's been bizarre in recent months has been the horoscopes of the time are extremely complex and very contradictory. And in some ways, by describing the general climate to most of us, it almost describes quite precisely what's going on in our government as well, which of course is alarming to almost everyone I know.
Yes.
It's almost as though part of the dynamic is that Neptune is the planet of fantasy and imagination, and it can be spirituality on its higher levels, but it also represents illusion and self-centeredness, and it's in the sign Pisces, which it rules, and it's in each sign for 15 years, so we're really in for the long haul, I'm afraid. And the idea of it is that it's very difficult to know who's telling the truth and who's not. And that's true for us on our individual lives basis, but it's also true for government. And I think that there's a real dissolution of structures and patterns and the way government functions and so on that really brings into question how the whole country works. And I think it affects all of us in profound ways.
Yeah, there is. And we were talking about this a little bit while John Coltrane was playing, that sometimes it feels a little bit like everything in the world is up for grabs right now.
Yeah, it is. And it is actually, it's almost like a takeover of the corporate world. And just in the sense that everything seems to be heading in that direction. And it's very alarming for a lot of people simply because the patterns and structures that we've grown up with are like dissolving before our eyes. And I think it's a kind of counseling process because you can look at it and you'll recognize that certain signs and certain planets are being activated. And I see it as a kind of educational tool also, just in the sense that by reading the newsletter or listening to it every 2 weeks, that you begin gradually to learn more and more about how astrology functions and the fact that it's actually much, much more than just your sun sign. So it's a very, very interesting process for a lot of people. I know that because I get lots of feedback from all over the world. Having lived in Europe for 30 years, I have many, many clients there as well as all over the U.S. So it's actually very interesting to converse and to connect with people because I get a lot of validation from them. Validation in the sense that they, contact me back again and just simply say, my God, I feel like everything is so complex in my life at this moment that, it really is a kind of solace to know that there's a reason for that.
Mm-hmm. You also have written a number of books, Tad. Tell me a little bit about those.
Yes, well, I've been doing astrology for a long time. I was originally an architect and graduated from Cornell University and worked in New York and Rome back in the 60s. But then I began doing astrology, and I've been doing it for more than 45 years now. But in recent years, I've been writing books that are more general and of more interest to a broader audience, because astrology, serious astrology, is quite limited in many ways. A lot of people read their horoscopes in the newspaper or something, but, you know, people wanting to take it to the next stage requires a bit of understanding and so on. So those books have a very limited audience. But in the last few years, I've done a book called Sacred Landscapes with a wonderful local photographer and friend of mine, Lynn Davis.
It's a beautiful book.
And it's really about why certain places are considered sacred and why we love them, why we see them in paintings and things of this sort. In fact, you could even say that the Hudson Valley is such a place because of the Hudson River School of Painters, but also because they just saw this kind of natural beauty, which was fantastic and still exists all around us. I think it's a great pull to this particular area.
What's another example of a sacred place, one other that's in your book?
Well, you know, a lot of them are basically representing certain principles. It's like a mountain represents the principle of ascent, of going up to heaven. In fact, in early cultures, mountains were often sacred, like the Himalayas or the Andes or even mountains in the west of the U.S., simply because it looked like if there were gods in the sky, that that's the way they would come down to earth. But also, if you wanted to ascend to heaven, that's the way you would go. So it's interesting because mountains are gradually replaced by pyramids, by stupas, you know, in the east, by temples, by cathedrals, by the buildings in New York City. So we still see evidence of those kind of places that mark places that are considered to be sacred. And in the same way, there's a feminine dynamic, which is caves and caves in mountains and things of this sort, which have always been sacred to the feminine because they're a bit like wombs. So we just talked about places that in many cases I've been to or Lynn has been to, and they're all over the U.S. They're all over Europe and Asia and South America. It's actually a very exciting book. It was published by Sterling in 2010.
And I'm sure still available on Amazon?
It's still available on Amazon. And I did a more recent book in 2012 called The Sacred Language of Trees.
Before we go on to The Sacred Language of Trees, I just have to mention that the one place on earth that I felt really was sacred was when I was in Turkey and I went to Mary's house at Ephesus. And you come down into this little valley and there was a magic there that I've never been able to explain, but it was there.
Well, that's exactly the point of sacred landscapes, because these places are special, and it doesn't matter whether you accept the belief systems that have been associated with these places over the years. When you see them, it evokes something very deep within you that you don't forget. And in fact, the subtitle of the book is called The Threshold Between Worlds, because when you enter a sacred place like that, it's almost as though you're opening up a whole different level of your own spirituality. And it cuts across religious beliefs. It's multicultural. And those places still exist today all over the place. You know, the Native Americans, for example, throughout the West had certain places that they just migrated towards. They, you know, passed through. They didn't create any monuments there, but they basically considered certain mountains, certain valleys, as being places where transformation occurred. And I've just always been interested in things like that because of my, you know, time being an architect. And of course, once you're an architect, you're always an architect. But the idea basically is that we need to revere nature at this time and place in our world because it's being pretty severely abused. And I think that trend is actually even, you know, increasing at the moment rather than getting better, because for many years it seemed as though there were more and more efforts to really clean the environment up and so on. But I think I consider it to be one of the most important issues for us at this particular time. And we need to preserve these places and to preserve nature, because it's been, you know, it's been proven by psychologists that a walk in the woods makes a huge difference. And those of us like you do, Matt, who live in the woods, realize that just the places around here, around Hudson.
Yeah, no, I feel that about sitting on my deck.
Absolutely. So I the Sacred Language of Tree takes the same principle a little bit further. And And the whole idea that, that throughout history, that humans have always seen trees as being very symbolic and significant. You know, think of the family tree.
Mm-hmm.
Think of the fact that, you know, when we're young, we climb in trees. I used to climb in trees all the time. It's very interesting because I remember very clearly when I was a kid, and I have photographs to demonstrate this, that, you know, I would climb up in trees, especially at night, and look at the stars as they passed across the branches, the tips of the branches. And I used to think that somehow the branches were connecting these stars together. Mm-hmm. And it was a very magical experience, which is still alive in me, you know, 65 or 70 years later. So, So I really do believe that also trees provide the oxygen that we breathe. They provide us with the paper to make books. They provide us with the furniture that we live with and eat on and so on. So, you know, it's incredibly powerful how these kinds of natural things that are so beautiful and so amazing and so necessary end up becoming seen as raw materials instead of having the sacred quality that they mm-hmm. have. And the book is really about a lot of legends and stories and myths from various cultures that really bring trees alive. And it's interesting because they're often seen as being feminine. Almost all religions, including Christianity, Judaism, Islam, actually had tree goddesses in the early stages of their development. And that, so this is something that really is of universal importance. And my books in recent years have been really trying to wake people up in a way to the beauty around them, to the symbolic significance of those things and so on.
Yeah. I'm always curious how people with such interesting backgrounds as yourself, after having lived in Europe for 30 years, end up here.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's interesting you say that because, as we know, there are a lot of interesting people both in Hudson and in the local communities and so on. And
on both sides of the river.
On both sides of the river, absolutely. And I just think that, I mean, I'm actually quite biased as well because it's in, my family has been in Hudson and in this particular area, Philmont and Claverick, since the 1700s. So
I didn't know that.
I have an ancestry that's Dutch on my mother's side of the family. And they were Dutch Reformed ministers, and they settled in this area. In fact, literally, the Dutch Reformed Church in Claverick, the first minister in 1776, was a direct ancestor of mine. And so, it in a funny way, it's like coming home. But I think there's something very magical about Hudson and about this whole area. It attracts a lot of incredibly literate, creative, visual, literary people, and it's a great place to live as a result.
Yeah, I've often said that I actually feel more at home here than I did even in the house where I grew up and the city where I grew up, which was a, you know, marvelous place. Minneapolis is my hometown, and it's a wonderful city. Mm-hmm. But I almost as soon as I arrived here, I thought, gosh, this feels like home, what home is supposed to feel like.
Well, of course, it's also interesting. It's an incredibly beautiful city. It's sighting. You know, I'm very interested in how things are sighted. That I don't know how many of you know this, but Warren Street has a very interesting orientation. The whole city does, which is it's oriented to the southeast, to the top of Warren Street, and the northwest to the riverside of Warren Street. So we're actually going at a 45-degree angle to that north-south-east-west dynamic.
Really?
And it's a very unusual one because it means that the – and you'll notice this if you spend time walking up and down Warren Street, that in the morning the sun is shining from, you know, from the direction of Ghent, for example, onto Warren Street, and then it gradually shifts so that around 11 o'clock in the morning it's heading straight down Warren Street. And then for the rest of the afternoon it makes its arc over towards the Catskills. And where I live on Lower Allen Street – every evening I watch the sun set over the mountains on the other side of the Hudson River, and it's an extremely beautiful little jut out into the river. And I think the whole environmental impact of Hudson is extremely important, which is why I've always been glad that a lot of people are spending time and energy to really make sure that the waterfront works properly and so on.
Yeah.
You know, it's a very good place because we're close enough to New York, obviously, to get in and out. And yet, at the same time, there are a lot of very beautiful buildings that friends of mine live in and around Hudson. And it's a fabulous place to live, for sure.
Mm-hmm. What else do you you do astrology? You do tarot readings?
Yes, I've done tarot for many years because it's like a slightly different symbolic language.
Mm-hmm.
It expresses a lot of the astrological principles. But you know, since I was an artist and I have been doing mandala paintings and a lot of astrological art and other things over the years, that at one point I began exploring tarot because the symbols are universal. There have been many, many, many different kinds of tarot decks created over the years. And in a way, they represent a kind of symbolic language for representing how we make our way through our lives. And I've developed all kinds of techniques to kind of work with this. In fact, for a while, I was doing, you know, kind of 15-minute tarot readings at Orr, you know, mm-hmm. down on 3rd Street. And it was fascinating because in 15 minutes, which seems like it is actually a very, very short period of time, people were coming in. And, of course, it's a bit chaotic because there was music playing and people drinking and various other things. But it was interesting because these little mini readings really did get to the core of things incredibly quickly. And mm-hmm. people were quite amazed. In fact, it amazed me in some ways also because, people are very complicated. It's a very complex time. We all have a lot of outer influences that have profound effects on us, as well as our own dynamic. You know, we have this need to express ourselves. And, you know, I would say particularly in Hudson, there are a lot of people, a lot of my clients here, are people that have various levels of self-expression that they want to bring into being. And both astrology and tarot are interesting in that they provide that kind of time element. It's not necessarily what to do, but rather when to do certain things. And it also, by understanding that kind of symbolic world, it opens up a whole new range of possibilities in terms of how we can really communicate those things that are close to us,
mm-hmm.
whether it's about relationships or about our work or our creativity. And so on.
Yeah, I just want to remind our listeners that this is WGXC 90.7 on the dial, WGXC.org on the internet, and we are talking with Tadman, and this is Matthew Tombers, and this is the morning show, Wednesday morning, May 24th.
Yes, I have a website in case you're interested to find out more about this.
Exactly. So
it's actually quite a complex website in the sense that there are a lot of different categories, but the address of the website is www.atmann.net, and my email address is very similar. It's atman@atmann.net. And the website's interesting because, you know, over the course of a relatively long lifetime, we diverge into different areas. And, you know, being an architect, you're combining mathematical skills with visual skills and artistic skills and the reality of making buildings and so on. So it leads off in many different directions. And in fact, I've been working on a very interesting project recently. I was approached by a couple from Brooklyn who are Danish. And they've just bought some land near Delhi, New York, which is west of Albany. It's about an hour and a half or so from Hudson. And it's in a beautiful, beautiful area with rolling hills. And they wanted, basically, they bought a piece of land that's probably 20-plus acres. And they intend eventually to move there, to build a house that's ecologically created, that has passive solar heating, that has its own water. They want to grow organic foods and vegetables. And so I did a feng shui consultation. Feng shui is another thing I do, which is a Chinese art of how to utilize a site. And it has to do with things like the way Hudson is set up, which is you want ideally, and this is just interesting because the particular site they bought fits a lot of these criteria in a very interesting way. If you have a piece of open land, you want it to slope down towards the south. which Hudson does. If you look at it, when you look at Allen Street, it drops off and goes down towards the port on the harbor. And also you want water, which symbolizes flow. Particularly in the southwest or the southeast, we actually have water in both of those places. Matt lives just outside of Hudson in Claverick, and there's a stream just to the south and east of his house.
Mm-hmm.
So we have water that's flowing down away from us in a way. And, of course, the Hudson River is unusual because it's tidal and flows in both directions. But the whole dynamic of it is for, and you want the ground to be higher behind you to protect against northern winds in the northern hemisphere. And this site that these people have chosen is perfect because it fits all of those criteria. So we walked around the land, and I basically showed them places that could be potential sites for their house and barns and garages and things of that sort.
Mm-hmm.
So I think these kinds of things are really all connected and integrated, and that we have to really recognize that Hudson is really a precious place to be. I know you do also, but I travel around the U.S. quite a lot and go to places like Santa Fe and up and down the coast of California and many places on the East Coast. And Hudson is very, very special in all kinds of ways. And over the years, it's attracted a lot of very creative people. So I think the atmosphere is extremely special.
Yeah, I think this – we've commented on this on the program before when I've been hosting that this area, both Columbia and Greene County counties, have attracted a very interesting melange of people.
Absolutely. I mean, I happen to practice Tibetan Buddhism, and I don't know if you know this audience, but you know, there are many Tibetan Buddhist centers located within 10 or 15 miles of Hudson, including a major one near Woodstock. And you know, in almost every direction from Hudson, there are Sufi centers and Buddhist centers and the Korean Buddhist center called Wan, which is just out Route 23.
Just so, beyond my house.
Yeah, exactly. And the idea is that these kind of religions that are maybe closer to the earth really do recognize the sacred nature of places. Mm-hmm. And that I don't think it's accidental that a lot of these kind of Eastern religions have found their American centers, you know, within a 20 or 30 mile radius of Hudson, just because it is quite sacred. And the Native Americans had even a ceremonial path that went across New York State. And I was born in Auburn, New York, which is in the Finger Lakes. It's at the northern end of Cayuga Lake, the five lakes that constitute the Finger Lakes. And I know that there's a town at the north end of each one of those lakes, and that ceremonial path of Native American cultures goes across the north of those five lakes, and it just passes nearby Hudson. So
mm-hmm.
there's a culture here that's been going on for much more than there have been settlers in the U.S., and
mm-hmm.
and that I think that when you really get close to the land and close to nature here, that you realize that we're very lucky to be in such a special place.
Yeah, it is. There was my sister lives in Florida, and when her husband had his 80th birthday, I was down there, and one of her neighbors had her master's in fine arts and had done her thesis on a member of the Hudson River school that had specialized in the Claver Creek, and she couldn't believe that she actually met somebody who actually
lived on it.
Lived on it, yes. She didn't think we existed, but we do. What other things are going on that we should talk about, Tad?
Well, you know, there are...
And this is Tad Mann.
Yes, thank you.
And I'm Matthew Tombers, and this is WGXC.org. And 90.7.
Well, we've been working on a project together, as a matter of fact,
we
Matt. We've been doing, with our friend in India, Roger Chowdhury, we've been doing documentary films in recent years, and we've been doing one in particular that is of particular interest because it involves this area. And in the 1890s, there was an Indian wise man called Vivekananda who came to the U.S. to the World Exposition in Chicago in the early 1890s. And he gave a talk that was very rousing because he basically said that he comes from the oldest religion of the world, which is Hinduism, and that one of the main principles is about acceptance, mutual acceptance, and that, you know, essentially when you look at religions, they all ultimately say the same things. And it was very striking, and he attracted a lot of people to what came to be known as the Vedanta Society. And we just thought that because he was one of the first people to bring the concept of yoga to America, or the concept of meditation, or the concept that Eastern religions were not primitive, but rather quite sophisticated in the way they describe and understand the mind and how we communicate and so on, that we decided that it was extremely important to make a film about this, to simply describe Vivekananda and his amazing message. That he spent quite a number of years in America before moving back to India, and he died relatively young, but he stayed for a while at a place called Ridgely Manor, which is just south of Kingston.
Mm.
And he was supported in a way by a number of quite significant couples who were both from Boston and from New York City that kind of donated residences to him so he could carry on his teachings and so on. And apart from being also very beautiful places, his message was quite profound, and he affected a lot of people that are significant people in Western culture. And like Aldous Huxley with The Doors of Perception, and William James, who taught psychology at Harvard for years. And it's very, very interesting because he affected a lot of people in a profound way, very much like my generation being born during the Second World War and growing up during the 60s, where we discovered kind of Eastern religions also, that he really brought these kind of concepts to the West and made them available to people. There are Vedanta centers all over the U.S. to this day. And we're in the process of creating this film, which is a very complex undertaking. In fact, Matt is a real master at the machinations of things like this. And so we're learning quite a lot from him. And you're teaching it as well, right?
I'm not teaching this semester.
Right.
I did a year ago now. I was teaching media and society at Columbia Green Community College, which was a really wonderful experience. To put this all in context of what we're doing is, Tad and I are working with our friend Raja Chowdhury in Delhi, putting together a film on Vivekananda called The First Guru. WTTW in Chicago has agreed to be the presenting station, and we're in that terribly difficult part of the process called raising money.
Right.
And we've raised some of it and have done some of the work, and right now we're in the middle of trying to raise the rest of it. So,
yeah, and it's very interesting because you discover really who's interested in these things, and it comes from many, many different quarters.
Yeah.
In fact, I was at a conference in Los Angeles last October, and I went to the Vedanta Center in Hollywood, of all places, and it's still functioning, and it still teaches people on a regular basis. It's a place where you can go to retreats and so on. But of course, the members were all of these kind of famous script writers and actors and actresses and so on. So it's actually, you know, it actually had quite a broad reach and much broader than one imagines. And it's also very, very interesting. I mean, just in doing research about it, which is my primary role, Raja and I kind of write it and research it and so on, that we just have discovered a lot of very valuable and interesting things. Like, for example, that, you know, yoga is a multi-leveled process in Vedanta, which is the religion of Hinduism. And Vedanta really basically says that there are all kinds of different levels of yoga. Hatha yoga is the most physical. It's certainly very valuable because it integrates, you know, the body into the whole spiritual scheme of things. But there are other levels of yoga, one of them ironically called Raja Yoga,
mm-hmm.
which I always kid Raja about, because Raja Yoga is really one of the highest forms of yoga, and it's about understanding the mind, which is one of the main factors of Tibetan Buddhism also. So, you know, the interest in these Eastern religions, they seem very foreign and esoteric and unusual, but the reality is that it really does show us how to use our minds, how to, you know, how to de-stress, how to go deeper.
Pull our mind and our body together.
Exactly.
So that we're one functioning unit, which is something I should probably be doing. I should probably be doing yoga, but I'm not.
Yeah. Well, you know, and again, the real yoga is actually what we bring into our lives on a day-to-day basis. And it is of great interest that, you know, meditation and things like Tai Chi or Qigong are really ways of kind of bringing your body and your mind and your spirit and your emotions into some kind of balance. And, you know, to take the whole discussion full circle, that's really the primary factor behind the way I do astrology also, which mm-hmm. is, you know, people want guidance and they feel a need to, you know, shift things at certain stages of their lives. And when they hit those stages, they tend to try to contact someone like me. And simply because my function really is to guide people to the right kind of information, the right sources, the right things to do, to begin to balance their lives, to begin to become more connected to the earth, to maybe change diet, to change exercise patterns, and begin to really live a life which is actually the kind of life that was lived in the Hudson Valley a couple of hundred years ago.
Yes. And remember, this is Tad Mann you're listening to. I'm slaughtering your name today, Tad.
I know.
My tongue is not working well.
Yes.
But I even was sufficiently caffeinated this morning. This is Tad Mann, and his website is www.atman.net.
Correct.
And this is WGXC.
Yeah, in fact, some of you may remember that I did have an ongoing astrology program on WGXC.
Ah, that's right.
For a number of years early on. I think I stopped it probably 3 years ago or so, but for about 2 or 3 years when WGXC was just beginning. You know, I loved sitting in this very room right here and doing a little astrology report. I think I did it every 2 weeks or so.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, maybe I should come in and check in with Matt periodically and do a little brief astrology update every once in a while to satisfy, because, of course, it's something we're all interested in. And it's something that I think will pay you for your interest if you begin to want to understand it. And if you want my newsletter, all you need to do is to contact me. Send me an email at atman@atman.net. And I'll put you on the list, and you'll be getting, you know, an email before every new and full moon, and it will give you some kind of insight into what's going on, into the craziness that we're all experiencing.
Yes, and let's pull this full circle and go back to the newsletter you sent last night, which I haven't read, but let's close up our conversation with just a little bit about what that newsletter said.
Yeah, well, one of the interesting issues is that we're in this, you know, the new moon is in Gemini tomorrow, and Gemini happens to be the sign of our president, and Gemini has certain very dualistic characteristics, meaning the typical Gemini, because the symbol of Gemini is the twins.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost as though Geminis have these two voices within them. One of them is saying X and the other saying Y.
Mm-hmm.
And so they naturally, they learn by contradicting themselves, and that's exactly what we're observing. But also at this particular time, right now, the planet Mercury governs mind. It governs how we think. In fact, the sign that Mercury is in shows the way in which your mental processes tend to function. And the planet Neptune represents imagination and fantasy and illusion. It represents things like cinema, but it also has to do with, you know, what we imagine to be true, whereas Mercury is what we know to be true. And our president has Mercury and Neptune in a square relationship, which is a tension relationship. And the gist of it is that it's not that he doesn't tell the truth. I have a feeling that he doesn't know what it is. And that by by...
You would not be the first to speculate that.
Well, I'm not the first to speculate that, and I'm not the only one to speculate this. But the idea is that, you know, in the course of his lifetime, it's almost like he's invented himself. And he's invented himself in so many multifarious ways, which, again, is very Geminian, that it's natural that these contradictions are going to come out in the way he relates to the world around him. It's like, you know, a large part of our population who voted for him were under the impression that he was out to help the poor person. But as the new budget that was just brought out a couple of days ago shows, that's the exact opposite of what he's trying to do. So, you know, I don't want to get political about it, but it is very interesting that, you know, we can see certain things about the existing climate right now based on the astrology of the people that are actually in a position to change things. And it is quite fascinating to understand that. Also, because those two planets, the way astrology works is planets connect to each other in various ways that show how the connection comes about. But, you know, there are other planets that connect to this aspect. And it's interesting because his Mercury and Neptune also relate to Mars, which is about desire, but also anger, and Pluto, which is about the public and also is about wanting to drastically change things, to break down existing structures and to allow new structures to evolve out of the remains. And if you think about it, that's typically his reaction to things. When something doesn't fit his plan, he, A, gets angry, and B, he blames it, first of all, on someone else or upon the society as a whole. And so it's actually very interesting because I find myself writing these newsletters to try to guide us into, you know, how best to deal with outer circumstances and the inner workings of our cosmology. And then I discover that I'm really almost talking about a pattern that the president is reflecting. So I do think in a bizarre way that he's reflecting the existing pattern of influences, and that, you know, one of the points I make in this new newsletter is that, you know, we have to really learn how to understand, to deal and work with that, i.e. the fragmentation of our lives, the extent to which new media or social media actually affect us, which is very profound. And I don't
Absolutely.
Think anyone really has the key to that yet.
No, we don't.
But I think because we're being exposed for the first time to such an incredible diversity and variety of information that we don't really have a clue where it's really coming from or how legitimate it really is.
Which is one of the things that I talked about when I was teaching, was that one had to learn the art of discernment.
That's right.
Over news. I had a conversation with someone one night that got fairly heated because she stated something that was untrue. And I said, you know, that's not really exactly the way this was. And she said, well, I read it on Facebook. And I went,
uh-oh.
That is not necessarily. I saw it on Facebook also, but I then went and checked the news, you know, more news sources to find out that what was on Facebook was not necessarily correct. Tad, it's been such a pleasure to have you here.
Well, thank you, Matt.
I will invite you back again, and we'll do
terrific.
Maybe a little segment on of what you did with your old radio show, and
right, sure.
We'll do that. And we're going to close out this hour by listening to a little bit of John Coltrane's Equinox.
Nice. Very appropriate, Matt.
Very appropriate. That's what I was looking for when you were chatting and I was fumbling around with my CD player. But anyway, that's what we're going to go out with. Tad, thank you so much for being here.
Matt, thank you. It's been a real pleasure.